Good evening, big historians. Are you ready to rock? Are you ready to rumble? This is how we do big history. We have various big history sections. I have one. Who are we?
Section 7.
I love Section 7. Yes. All right. My name is Eric Sinrod. I'm an adjunct professor here. I'm teaching two sections of big history, actually Section 7 and also a smaller section. It is my absolute privilege to introduce to you our own rock star, John Duvall. Let me tell you about John. John is an associate professor of communications and media studies, and he's now in his lucky 13th year here at Dominican. After graduating from USC Cinema School, fight on USC, and editing sound effects for a decade in Hollywood, John turned to education and in 2011 received his PhD in transformative studies from the California Institute of Integral Studies. His doctoral thesis examined the impact of fossil fuel depletion on the future of world civilization. Just a little tiny topic, don't you think? While teaching at Dominican, John has served for many years on the university's sustainability committee, proposing ways to make our campus more green, which is a good thing. So without further ado, let's give a very enthusiastic welcome to John Duvall.
Thank you, Eric. It's one of the advantages of being a USC grad that wherever you go, the USC mafia is in support of you. I'm very lucky to be here tonight because this morning when I got out of the shower, I slipped and fell on a rug. And that hurt. And then as I was leaving the house, the strap to my laptop broke and my computer fell on the ground. That's where my PowerPoint is. So there are some very, very powerful forces trying to keep me from talking to you tonight. I gotta get my little clicker turned on here. Okay. Why am I here? Why are you here? I know why I'm here. I've been studying issues of fossil fuel depletion for more than a decade now. It was involved in my PhD study, as Eric mentioned, and I've been interested in questions of environment and questions about things like climate change for about 40 years now. I remember reading The Limits to Growth back in 1976. And I've been following and tracking the atmosphere, the studies, the research around environmental problems for a long, long time. So it's my pleasure to come to you tonight and tell you that it is really the end of the world as we know it. And it's not because of, as the movies show, not because of earthquakes or meteors or aliens. It's because we're at the end of the fossil fuel age, which is the energy source that's supported our industrial revolution for the last two centuries. And that's all changing. And I'm going to explain a little bit why it's changing, and in the end, about how you can think about responding to these changes that are coming. But I also wanted to mention, I'm not going to ask you right now why you're here, but I know most of you are here because you have to be. And I hope that by the time we're done, you will feel like you've been given some information that will be important to you for the rest of your lives. Because I think that that's the case. And this isn't what you would call academic study in the sense of studying interesting things because you're interested in them or your professors want you to study them. These are really, really important things that are going to impact how you live your lives. So Once upon a time, we were all hunters and gatherers. And a little bit later after that, we were farmers. From about 10,000 BC to just about really 200, 300 years ago, life was very, very different for the human race. And I don't want to idealize this. I don't want to romanticize this. Things were tough back then. You know, the life expectancy was about half of what it is right now. We didn't have modern medicine. We didn't have a lot of the technology we have. We didn't have a lot of the comforts. But what we did have was a human race that mostly lived within sort of harmony with nature. Not completely. I mean, there were some species that were driven into extinction even during this period, the woolly mammoths and such. And there was a lot of deforestation because people were burning a lot of wood. So it wasn't like complete harmony with nature, but it was generally a steady state sort of life. Now, I want to look at once upon a time, you know, we got most of our energy from fire. We used it to cook food. We used it to make pottery and kilns. Once upon a time, most of what we built things with and what we used to burn was wood. Once upon a time, we used animals for power and built, you know, controlled water through irrigation. And once upon a time, most of our power came from, well, this is water and wind, right? Water and wind, except in the form of windmills and water mills. And look at this. You're going to get a little data here tonight. From 10,000 BC up to about something like about 300 BC, there was very, very little change in the population of the world. And also very little change in the amount of energy consumed. The red line here represents the energy consumption of the human race, and the blue line is the population. And you can see that somewhere around, you know, 1800, all of a sudden everything spiked up in an incredibly sharp way. I've got a little bit more detailed look at that period of time. In 1820, just right after the American Revolution, there were only 1 billion people in the world. That's only about twice as many people as lived in the world around the time of Christ. Around the year zero, it was about 500 million people, and by 1800, it was about 1 billion. So in almost two millennia, 2,000 years, the population of the world had only doubled. And look at where it is now. Only 200 years later, we're over 7 billion now, because this is a little bit of an old graph. We're over 7 billion people, so we've got seven times as many people in the world now as there were at the time of the American Revolution. That's astonishing. That's an astonishing change in the growth of the population. And why? How has this been made possible? Well, we have to reflect that the principles of ecology apply to the human species as well as any other species. What happens to any species is if there's food available, then the species will expand and grow. And if the food supply shrinks, there will be a die-off, and there will be a smaller number of representatives of that species. So within a finite system, and the world is a finite system. Our planet is a finite system. It's round. We've only got so many resources. And so we cannot possibly grow our economic consumption. We cannot possibly grow our population indefinitely. Humanity has already overshot, in the opinion of most population ecologists, the carrying capacity of the Earth, which means simply a whole lot of people are getting poorer and struggling for survival. This is the reason. This is the reason for these profound changes. Fossil fuels. We call it the Industrial Revolution, But we really should have called it the fossil fuel revolution, because it's fossil fuels that have really allowed this vast expansion of economic production and population. First, coal. Coal was the main fuel in the latter part of the 19th century, ran the growth of the railroads and a lot of factories and such. And then, here I can move forward here. Steam power was originally came from burning wood, but then came from burning coal. And then a natural gas is another fossil fuel, supposedly cleaner than oil, but not necessarily. And oil. And oil is the biggie. We have never had a fuel as compact as oil in terms of what we can get out of it. I think the next, hold on a sec. Thought I was going to see something else there. There's a difference between energy and technology. When we think about the future, when we think about how civilization works, energy is the natural substances from natural energy flows from which we create work. We burn various forms of energy. And technology is the inventions that allow us to take advantage of those energy flows. But all you have to do to understand this is ask, why didn't the Romans fly around in airplanes? Why didn't the ancient Greeks drive cars? It's not because they weren't smart or that they didn't have technological intelligence. It's because they didn't have the energy to facilitate the invention of those things. And as soon as we started using coal and then using oil, a lot of people like Thomas Edison started figuring out, hey, we can make a lot of inventions that utilize this. But without the energy, none of that technology would be possible. And that's still true in our present day with cell phones. So this is an example. How useful is a car without gas? You know, think about anything you use, any piece of technology you use. How good is your microwave if there's no electric grid? The energy is more crucial than the technology to promoting civilization and our civilized lifestyle. Now here's another, this is a graph similar to the one on population, but this shows the growth of energy use in terms of the fossil fuels. So over here, you know, we start back at 1850, right before the Civil War, and move to about 10 years ago, 15 years ago, and you can see how much of our energy came from coal, oil, and gas, and how the use of those technologies, of those resources, grew incredibly. And the images show that the things that came along with that, the electric motor, the gasoline engine, television, commercial aviation, all the way up to the microchip. And notice how little of the energy we get, or we have gotten in the past, comes from nuclear and renewables. Just two or three more charts I want to give you an overview of, I'm going to get this out of the way. It's just obstructing my walking path. A view of some of the data about where our energy comes from and how we use it. So world energy by source, this chart is about 7 years old, shows oil 37%, natural gas 24%, coal 27%. So those three fossil fuels together provide something like about 85% of the energy consumed by the world just 7 years ago. You may also note that as you look at that pie chart, there's no slice for renewables at all, except for hydro. I think hydro, you know, water is a renewable resource, as long as it rains. But there's no solar, there's no wind, there's none of the things we identify as renewable resources. By sector of the economy, 40% of our energy goes to produce electric power, which is the biggest consumer, 29% transportation, and that's all the transportation, all the cars, all the planes, all the big earth-moving machinery, and so on, diesel trucks. Industrial 21%, and residential and commercial 10%. Now, when I look at this chart, the one question that I have is, where does agriculture come in? Agriculture must be mostly in that industrial part, but we don't realize how much of our agriculture, mass food production is dependent on fossil fuels, because we have fertilizers that are fossil fuel based, we have pesticides that are fossil fuel based, and we have agricultural machinery that runs on fossil fuels, not to mention transporting things to the supermarket and so on. So an awful lot of fossil fuel use or exploitation goes into agriculture. And lastly, this is equity. This is a question of equity. Not just how much energy are we using, but who's using that energy. As you can see, the United States, this is measured in gigajoules, energy measure of gigajoules per person. And you can see that the United States, average United States person consumes about twice as much energy as people in Europe and in the former Soviet Union. And the rest of the world trails far behind. Even China, we talk a lot about China because people know China is now the biggest greenhouse gas emitter past the United States. But they have a whole lot more people there, like 1.5 billion people or something like that. So the average Chinese person still only uses, 15% as much energy per person as the average person here. So that means that the energy you use is equivalent to, 6 or 7 times what the average Chinese person uses. So it's like you're 6 or 7 Chinese people. Finally, mass extinction. We're in the middle of what ecologist Elizabeth Kolbert called the first mass extinction in the history of the world to be caused by another species, by a living species, and that's us. The rate of extinction right now is 1,000 times the normal rate of extinction. Species have always gone extinct over time. Extinction is nothing new. But all the other extinctions that you probably already read about in big history classes were caused by, meteors or vast environmental changes due to the sun or whatever, or the tilting of the Earth's axis. But right now it's us. We're driving vast numbers of species to extinction or to the brink of extinction. And this has incredible consequences because we depend upon a lot of these species to be part of the web of life, be part of the ecology that produces. It's like, for example, honeybees. Honeybees are in danger. They're having mass die-offs, culture collapses of honeybees, and honeybees help help flowers grow and other things. So all this comes together, all these changes come together in what geologists are calling a new era. If you've studied the ancient, prehistoric times with the Cretaceous period and the Jurassic period and all that, we are now living in the Anthropocene. And the Anthropocene is defined as an epoch dating from the commencement of significant human impact on the Earth's geology and ecosystems. And of course, a big part of that is climate change. I'm not going to talk too much about climate change today because I think, frankly, most people already know about this. Some people in Washington, D.C. apparently don't. But we're here in Marin County, so mostly I'm going to talk about, there are three big topics that are affecting, that kind of define the Anthropocene. The first is climate change, but I'm not going to talk too much about climate change. And then I've talked already about population growth, but the main thing I'm going to focus on here tonight is what we call peak oil. Just by a show of hands, who has actually heard the term peak oil before? Yeah, practically nobody. Peak oil is a controversial term, but what it means basically is that, as we said earlier, fossil fuels, including oil, are non-renewable resources. There's only so much of them in the ground. And at the point of which we've gone through, we've extracted half of the oil that is either physically recoverable by technology or economically recoverable in terms of being profitable to produce, at that point, we will not be able to produce any more oil. It doesn't mean we're not going to produce any more oil, but we won't be able to increase the amount of oil that we grow, or that we extract. Which means that over time, over decades, the amount of oil produced by the world will start to decline. It's not going to go away. We're not going to run out of oil. There will always be some oil in the world somewhere in the ground. But the problem is, we won't be able to afford to get to it, because it will be so hard to extract, so environmentally destructive to extract, and so physically difficult to extract, that we'll have to transition over to some other form of energy. Now, we've already picked the low-hanging fruit when it comes to oil. This is a chart, oil discoveries. You have to discover oil before you can extract it. You know, you have to find oil, find places where there is oil to go after. And it will probably be a shock to you to know that oil discovery actually peaked around 1964. That's half a century ago. The discovery of new sources of oil, of new fields, new oil plays, actually peaked half a century ago. Now, it stands to reason that if we're discovering less oil, eventually we're going to be extracting less oil. And that's also true. I don't think I have a chart on this. Let me just hang here for a minute. Conventional oil production, when we think of oil production, we usually think of the derricks with the gushers, where you just stick a hole in the ground and the oil just shoots right up. And that's what we used to call oil production. But in the United States, or in the world actually, world conventional oil production actually peaked 12 years ago. And ever since 12 years ago, we've been extracting less oil from derricks. So why hasn't total oil production gone down? It's because we have new technologies. I'll get to that in a sec. But I want to just point out, in 2005, there was a study done by the government. This was way back during the second George W. Bush administration, headed by a man named Robert L. Hirsch. And I'm not going to have a lot of slides that have a lot of text on them. But this one is worth reading, because the conclusion of this study was that the peaking of world oil production presents the U.S. and the world with an unprecedented risk management problem. As peaking is approached, liquid fuel prices and price volatility will increase dramatically, and without timely mitigation, the economic, social, and political costs will be unprecedented. They use the word unprecedented twice now in this summary. Viable mitigation options exist on both the supply and demand sides, but to have substantial impact, they must be initiated more than a decade in advance of peaking. So if, as many people believe, world oil production is peaking right about now, what this person was saying 10 years ago was that we should have started planning for this 10 years ago. And have we? Have we had what some people have said was we needed a World War II level, a World War II level impetus? Like in World War II, everybody pitched in. Everybody went to the men went into the military, the women went into the factories. They had gardens in their backyards. Everybody was involved in that effort. And we have nothing like that today in regards to energy. Most of us are still expecting the government and the corporations to take care of us. And many people think that world oil production is peaking right about now. And yet we've got a government right now in Washington that's doubling down on fossil fuel production, trying to reignite more coal production. Now, you have to think, if you remember that fossil fuel reserves are limited. They're non-renewable. If you think about it in comparison to your savings account, you know, if you've got, you know, $10,000 in your savings account and you decide to burn through it even faster, what do you think is going to happen? You're going to run out of it even faster. So if our response to our current energy situation is to double down on what's been keeping us going for the last two centuries, that means that we're going to bring on this crisis I'm talking about that much sooner. Because of this, there are a lot of projections about what's going to happen in the future, and there's no real consensus about this. It wouldn't be totally honest to say that we know this is going to happen, because this is a kind of a collection of what a whole lot of fossil fuel geologists and scientists and academics are saying. But according to this estimate, total energy use will peak somewhere around here. Isn't that right about where we are right now? 2015? And what's going to happen after that is a progressive reduction in fossil fuel use, because those fossil fuels will become increasingly expensive and environmentally destructive and materially difficult to extract. And so that means if most of you were born around the year 2000, I'm about 70, so by the time you're my age, you'll around 2075, the world will be producing less energy than it was all the way back in 1965, when there were about 2 billion or 3 billion fewer people in the world. This is pretty scary. There is, by the way, a little bit of increase, and the green is renewables and the blue is hydro, so some things will be increasing a little bit, but it's important to note that they won't be increasing enough to compensate for the loss of those fossil fuels. So now I'm going to get to what I consider the most important thing to understand about this whole picture in terms of its relevance to our present time. If a fox chases a rabbit, first of all, it has to catch the rabbit and eat the rabbit. But it has to get enough food out of that rabbit to give it enough energy to keep chasing other rabbits. If the fox doesn't get enough money or doesn't get enough food, enough energy from the rabbit, then it will starve to death. Our bodies rely on constant energy input in the form of food and, to some extent, solar energy and such. But there is a balance. We have to have a positive balance of energy input to energy output in order to stay alive. This is true of any living creature. Now, we have a concept called energy return on energy invested, which is the abbreviated EROEI. And this simply means the ratio between the energy we're able to extract from the ground versus the energy needed to produce that energy. And there are a lot of different kinds of energy that go into producing energy. There's financial energy, a whole lot of money that the oil companies, for example, need to buy the machinery, the materials to do this. They have to have physical labor, people working. And people consume energy, and they have to be paid. And then other just forms of electrical and other kinds of energy. So if you don't get enough energy out of a process in order to keep doing that process, then that process is going to come to an end. Now, historically, At the turn of the 20th century, back in the early days, the ratio of the return on investment for oil production was about 100 to 1. That meant you put one unit of energy into the process and you got like 100 units back. That's almost a perpetual motion machine, you know, it's almost free energy. If you could put a dollar into the bank and get $100 back, what a deal that would be. By the turn of this last century, by just, you know, 17 years ago, that ratio was already down to 20 to 1, which means we're having to put a whole lot more energy into getting energy than we're getting, than we were before. 20 to 1 still sounds okay. You're still getting more energy out than you're putting in. But the estimates are by the mid-20th century, 21st century, you know, 30, 35 or so years from now, that ratio could be down to 5 to 1. Now, there's a lot of debate among ecologists and economists what ratio we need to basically sustain our civilization. But it's obviously got to be a positive ratio. It's got to be a positive number. And I've seen estimates as little as like 2.5 to 1 and as high as 7 to 1. But if we really come down to a 5 to 1 energy return on investment ratio, then we're going to be struggling to keep our civilization going. What's that? Can you just press later? Okay. I love Max. So what the two things that are really keeping America American oil production going right now, increasing at all, are fracking and tar sands. These are what we call alternative sources of fossil fuel energy. Fracking, you probably heard a lot about in the news. It's many people think it pollutes the water in the area where fracking takes place. It's very, very energy intensive. It means what you're doing with fracking is you're breaking up rocks that have oil inside them, and that's a lot more, it's a lot tougher to do than just you know, getting liquid oil out of the ground. And even maybe worse than that is the tar sands in Alberta. This is what the tar sands look like. This used to be grassland and forest land. Look at it now. These are not very satisfactory ways of getting oil. They're incredibly polluting, environmentally destructive. They're destructive of habitat for wildlife. They are very, very expensive. They require a lot of money and a lot of energy inputs, and so that's why they only average about 5 to 1 energy ratio. So maybe renewables. Maybe we could save ourselves from renewables. Maybe if we can't afford fossil fuels anymore, we could go with wind and solar and stuff like that. But as you can see here, Most of the renewables are actually have lower energy ratios even than oil does now, and solar PV is lower, and some things like biodiesel and ethanol are barely have a positive energy return ratio at all. A lot of people think we shouldn't even be, you know, wasting our money and our energy even trying to get biodiesel. So this doesn't bode very well for the future in terms of replacing the oil that we're going to be losing and the coal that we're going to be losing as these things get harder to extract and more expensive and so on. So a lot of crises could come. And this is where we get into scary stuff. The first thing we're probably going to run into is transportation fuel shortages, because over 90% of our transportation fuel still comes from fossil fuels. The diesel trucks that bring our food and our consumer items to market, the airplanes that we fly in, the cars that we drive, if they're we're very likely going to hit the wall where it becomes, you know, next to impossible to do all the things with in transportation that we want to do. Unstable electrical generation, you may know or may not that there are many, many countries in the world where the grid goes down a couple of times a day where you can't get electrical energy because of problems with the grid. And one thing, if everybody got an electric car, you know, theoretically, if everybody bought an electric car, we could not have any problems with gas with cars. But if everybody literally bought an electric car, we'd have to have a grid that's about 40% more powerful than it is today. And where would the energy for that grid come from? There are a lot of people trying to solve these problems. Elon Musk is trying to build bigger batteries and so we can store energy, because one of the problems with wind and solar is they're intermittent. Sun isn't always shining, wind isn't always blowing. So those are intermittent, and if we can't figure out some way to store those energy from those sources, then we don't have it. Uncertain food production, I already talked about how much our industrial agriculture system is dependent on pesticides and other sorts of fossil fuel products. So there's no guarantee that we'll be able to keep producing food at the rate we're doing. And economic depression. There's a very, very tight relationship between oil availability and the economy. Something like five of the last serious recessions were accompanied by, and possibly caused in part by, higher fuel prices. People forget back in 2008, before this last huge recession that we had, that oil prices had risen to almost $150 a barrel within a year to a half a year before that recession. So it wasn't all home prices, and it wasn't all derivative hedging and stuff. Okay, let me see what time it is. Okay, I gotta move. Also, we talked about climate change. Climate change will lead to more rising sea levels, expanding desertification in some areas, more intense storms, and something like 50% of the world's population live within 50 miles of a sea coast. Most of the world's major cities are on the oceans. So if those sea levels rise to make those cities uninhabitable, a lot of people are going to have to move. And it's happening right now in Bangladesh. Many Bangladesh is already having sea level rise, and a lot of people are trying to cross the border into India. And the Indian government is having to reinforce its borders with more military troops to keep these people from coming in. And what's been happening in Syria, the war in Syria, and this is something else that's really underreported in the media, is that the civil war in Syria was preceded by 5 years of the worst drought that Syria had ever seen, which caused a lot of social and political instability that led in part to the rise of ISIS and the civil war in Syria, and that led to a whole lot of conflicts between the United States and Russia and so on. So, you know, this is happening right now. It's not something that we're looking into the future for. The war in Iraq, the Bush administration began, wasn't really about weapons of mass destruction. It was really about Iraq's oil, because Iraq has more cheap, unextracted oil than any other country in the world. And that's, you know, we wanted to get our hands on Iraq's oil, and that's why we went into Iraq and why we had the war. Didn't work very well, by the way. Iraq's selling a lot of oil these days to China and other kind of Russia. And also, finally, new diseases and plagues. You know, when the climate changes, diseases migrate across national borders and move into warmer areas. So this raises the critical problem of, could our society actually collapse? And certainly in the past, a lot of major societies have collapsed. The Roman Empire collapsed. The Mayan Empire collapsed. There have been empires in China and India that collapsed historically. So there's no reason to think that our lifestyle can go on indefinitely the way it is, especially given these factors I've been talking about. And when a society collapses, you experience a decline in complexity, resources, population, technological sophistication, and knowledge, leading to institutional, political, and social disorder. And I would say some of this we're seeing today, the beginnings of it, not the worst of it, but the beginnings of it. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, in considering, she was talking about the stages that people go through to deal with grief when they're faced with something like terminal cancer. But I think that this sort of model applies to our talking about the collapse of our society. First you go into denial where you say, some of you may be thinking that right now. Oh, this is all a load of whatever, you know. This can't be real. We can't be in this bad shape. Certainly, this guy is exaggerating or something like that. And then once you realize that no, these things are real, then it turns into who to blame. You know, are we going to blame the government, blame the corporations, blame somebody? We got to blame somebody. It can't be our fault. And then the bargaining stage is kind of where you say, that's where you go, the renewables. Renewables will save us. More wind, more solar, more water, maybe something else like nuclear, thorium or something. And then if you decide that all those things aren't going to be sufficient to replace fossil fuel energy, then you get depressed and you say, oh my God, this is real. We're all, this is, everything is going to fall apart. It's the end of the world as we know it. But once you get, there is a place when, once you get past that depression, you can get to a place of acceptance, which is actually very liberating. Where you say, okay, this is where we are. This is what we're facing. What are we going to do about it? I'm going to skip over. I've got a couple of slides here talking about what we can do. And I'm hoping that Dan May will pass this PowerPoint on to you so you can look at some of these things. More conservation and efficiency, more renewable energy will help. Using more public transportation, bicycling, mixed-use walkable neighborhoods, having less people, you know. And maybe some new energy sources will come along to relieve us of some of this burden. But we don't know. It's not very wise to put put all of our money on new sources that have been thought about for years but haven't been able to be developed yet. Because there's usually problems with those energy sources like nuclear and hydrogen and so on. So what I want to close with is, what can you do? You know, assuming that you buy a significant amount of what I'm saying up here, what can you do to try to prepare for the rest of your life to deal with some of these things? So I'm going to go through about 8 different things. Financial capital. Money is important. We don't know what will happen to money if the government really collapses and we don't get our Social Security and we don't get our Medicare. We don't know. And we don't even know if the banks will close and our money that we've saved will be gone. But still, it's better to save it than not to save it. And it's better to avoid getting into debt. And as students, I'm sure a lot of you are dealing with that one right now. And reduce consumption. Don't spend as much money on stuff you don't need. One of the most important assets you have is your health. And so if you can stay healthy, eat better, have a good diet, get plenty of exercise, that will help sustain your health and possibly forestall a lot of medical bills down the line. Material capital is important. Housing, you know, everybody needs to have a place to live, and notice that house has solar panels on it. And other sorts of physical resources. Tools, it's good to have tools so you can, if you can't afford to hire a repairman, maybe you can fix your plumbing yourself or something like that. This over here is an emergency preparedness kit, by the way, which I have for in case there's an earthquake or a fire or something and I have to leave my house like I did 3 weeks ago. Knowledge is important. Not just intellectual knowledge. I mean, you're better off if you finish and you have a degree. I don't want to minimize the importance of what you're engaged in right now. But other kinds of knowledge are important too. Practical skills, the ability to repair things, make things. There are a lot of skills that people had 100 years ago that have been lost. just because we've been able to rely so much on technology. Emotional capital. Emotional capital. To what do you turn? To what belief system or what interior reserves do you turn when you really are facing hard times? I think it helps to have some sort of a spiritual grounding. I don't think it matters really too much what the tradition of that spiritual grounding is, but it's important to have some relationship between yourself and some higher power in order to deal with real challenges in life. And that's why prayer and meditation, I think, are good things to engage in. Social capital, your families, your social networks. This is a Quaker meeting over here on the right. It may be a religious group, it may be a political group, it may be a book club, I don't know. But who do you turn to? Who is in your social network? Who are the people that share your values and share your concerns? And are they going to be there to support you if you have trouble, and you'll be there to support them if they have trouble? Boy, I tell you, in the fires up in Sonoma just a week ago, I saw so much of this. You know, I have friends who had to go live with other friends or other family members because they were burned out of their homes. And this is exactly the sort of thing I'm talking about. And cultural capital, where you live is important. You know, what resources you have, if you have hospitals or functional legal systems or libraries or things that are important resources in your community to have. And finally, I think lastly, is time. We can all fritter away our time watching the latest TV show or sports events and things, but think about what use you're putting your time into. Is whatever you're doing right now really the most important thing you could be doing? Or are there other things that are more crucial in your long-range interests? Time is one of the most valuable resources we have, and so use your time well. Life after fossil fuels can still be productive and creative. The Buddha never had electricity. Jesus Christ never drove a car. Leonardo da Vinci never flew in an airplane, although he tried to invent one. And George Washington never had a cell phone. So, you know, keep your material possessions in perspective and value those things that will enable you to live a good, valuable, enriching life without so much stuff. And I think at that point, we got about 5 minutes left. Thank you. We just got about 5 minutes for questions.
So we're going to do some questions and answers. I'm especially looking for my section 7 and my honors section 3. So I want to see some hands right now. We got a valuable non-renewable resource right here. Kelly, thank you.
I hope I'm renewable for a little bit longer.
This is Kelly from section 7.
Hi, Kelly.
Hi. So my question is, what is your opinion on the recent decision to withdraw from the Paris Climate Agreement?
Well, you can probably imagine, I think it puts us as one of, I think, two countries in the world who withdrawn from that agreement. It puts us in a terrible position. We should be a leader, you know, as one of the biggest greenhouse gas emitters and one of the biggest consumerist nations in the world. We need to be a leader in reducing greenhouse gases and reducing climate change, and instead we're the tail being wagged by the dog of the rest of the world. It's kind of it's very embarrassing at best and depressing at worst.
Okay, yeah. I'm looking for another one. Let's see some hands. Come on.
You've got to have questions about all
this
stuff.
Yeah. Here we go. I don't know you. You're not from my section, but that's great. What is your name?
Nick. I said, when do you think the world will end if there's no change, like fossil fuel-wise?
Well, unfortunately, the end of the world... First of all, the world is not going to end. I mean, even the worst-case scenario is even if our civilization gets destroyed and we're all back living in the Stone Age, the world will heal somehow. I don't think all life on Earth is going to be wiped out. I don't really honestly think the human species will be wiped out. But all those things that we rely on to give order to our lives, governments, economies, and so on, those things may go. I don't think we're going to wake up some morning and find out that everything has fallen apart. I think it's going to happen in stages. I think we're actually in the first stage of it right now. Ever since around 2000, when we made the poor decision of going into the Iraq War, I think that was something. And the reason the economy isn't bouncing back the way we hoped it would from 2008's recession has a lot to do with the fact that we're not able to get as much cheap energy as we used to, and that drives up the price of everything we use energy for, and it also makes us do a lot of things. Like the banking system's been pumping a lot of money into the system, a lot of deficit financing and quantitative easing and stuff to try to keep the economy afloat, and that's not good in the long run because it makes for more debt. So I think it's going to be like a drip, drip, drip. I don't think the world is going to end on any particular day, or date, or year, or even decade. But I think what scares me about when I look into your guys' faces and my students' faces is I'm afraid things are going to get progressively worse through as your lives go on. Each decade may be a little bit more difficult than the last one, and so that's why you still have time to adjust, and maybe we'll get some leadership in this country at some point where we start doing the right things again. But we could go the other way. You know, as things get more difficult, people could say, well, we need a Putin, or we need a Stalin, or somebody, or a Mao, or a Hitler to solve all the problems for us. And sometimes that's the way things go when things get really tough. You turn to the wrong people to provide leadership. So, you know, this is because of a long-winded answer to your question, but I don't think it's going to happen all at once, but it's going to happen a little bit at a time over decades. I think it'll be pretty clear in a decade or two that things are going in the direction that I'm describing here.
Okay, John, we have one last question from Chelsea from Section 7.
Hey, Chelsea.
So what do you think the next major fuel source will be?
Well, I think we're going to be increasingly relying on wind and solar, and hopefully with battery storage that helps us make the maximal use of those things. It's possible that we might turn to something like thorium nuclear, you know, that has some advantages over the traditional type of nuclear power. But there are a lot of political and economic obstacles to going nuclear, and I honestly don't know in my own mind, whether that would be a good direction to go or not. So I really doubt that there's anything out there that we don't know about now that's going to magically appear and replace oil. So I think we'll probably be going with more renewables, but I think we're still going to, at least half of the replacement of oil is going to have to come from conservation and efficiency. If we're going to, you know, prop up our standard of living.
All right. Well, thank you for the excellent questions. Thank you for a wonderful presentation.
Thank you.
A major wake-up call. Good job, big historians.